Good morning. We read this morning from Matthew chapter 23, and this is the fifth sermon or discourse in the Gospel of Matthew. If you're reading through Matthew, you'll have big collections of red letters in spots if you have one of those kinds of Bibles, which you shouldn't. Chapters 5 through 7, the Sermon on the Mount. Chapter 10 is a missionary discourse. Chapter 13 is about parables. Chapter 18 is about the church. And chapters 23 through 25, the same number of chapters at the beginning of Matthew with the Sermon on the Mount. 3 is his sermon warning Israel of its imminent doom. What Micah says, your field will be plowed, which is not a positive idea. This is a severe look in Matthew 23 at the Pharisees, whom Matthew tends to blame for all the problems in Israel because he sees them as the leaders. Who were the Pharisees in the first century? They were a very small minority group within the Jewish people. Only maybe 6,000, maybe 5,000. Josephus gives us numbers. His numbers are never trustworthy. He tends to exaggerate everything, especially when it concerns himself. The Pharisees were famous for making the Torah, the Pentateuch, or the first five books of the Old Testament, the laws, doable for ordinary people. They, in fact, created the first home Bible study movement. In the first century, they would get people together, and they would read Torah, and they would explain Torah with interpretations or rulings, which we now call halakha, which is the rulings, and they became the official rabbinic documents. And these rulings gave them even more specifics on how to obey the Torah. You can't work on Shabbat. But what does work mean? So they have to define it. And they gave you 40 things that involve work. And so if you followed their interpretations, you could be a Pharisee. Good for you. The Pharisees worked ordinary jobs. They were bivocational. And these are the people who became the influential leaders and interpreters of the law in the first century. They had what we would call today, and if you were at Trinity in the days when I was there, Paul Hebert called it a bounded set approach. So you had to follow them in every regard to be involved in their group. If you thought there was a little toleration on the edges, you became a Sadducee or an Essene or a Zealot. You didn't get to be a Pharisee. So they had a really tight idea of who was in and who was out. So I'm always asked, who are the Pharisees in our world today? I'm going to tell you. The Sadducees are like our priests, like Daniel. And the Pharisees are like our professors, like Dana. Now, I'm not a professor today. I'm a deacon. So the Pharisees were the knowledgeable interpreters of Scripture, but they were like lawyer interpreters. So this is the people that was sort of shaping how everybody understood the Torah, and Jesus saw them as a problem. The result of Jesus' very strong language, you could call it vituperative rhetoric, his very strong language is that now we have a stereotype of a Pharisee. So that Pharisee means hypocrite. But many first century Pharisees were not hypocrites. They were a denomination in the landscape of Judaism. So people in my world, professors who are like Pharisees, we like to make sure people are using this term Pharisee accurately and not simply as a stereotype. So to equate Pharisee with hypocrite is a little unnerving for the historians. But at the same time, Jesus uses this word very critically of the leaders, the official theological leaders of Israel. Last week, Jay quoted a passage in the Bible from his own Bible, and it was, "Leaders matter." So I'm going to quote that part of the Bible, which doesn't exist this week to begin with, because he's right. Leaders really do matter. Good leaders create a gospel culture. Bad leaders create a toxic culture. They're not the only ones to blame, but they are the easiest ones to blame. And we don't want to, now, in talking about leaders, simply want to talk about the professors and the priests and the pastors among us and the potential pastors among us who are studying in seminary. I want to say that everybody who's in a position of leadership, whether it's in the home, whether it's at work, whether it's in a neighborhood or a community, can create a good culture, and they can also create a toxic culture. A bad parent can create a toxic culture in the house. A bad boss can create a toxic culture at work. So this is not just about pastors. This is the idea that leaders really do matter. Now, not all leaders are great. Some leaders, in fact, are eccentric, like Professor Otto Michel, a German professor. And I read this about Otto Michel, who has written some brilliant commentaries on the New Testament. And we're talking about leaders, so I can talk about people in my field today. A contemporary colleague of Otto Michel described his teaching performance like this. Michel was a respected authority in his subject on the New Testament and later was the author of some very important commentaries. It was not unusual, however, for his spiritual temperament to get a little out of control. He sometimes, for instance, had visions during his lectures and fell into ecstatic silence. Shocked or enraptured by this, depending upon their point of view, his listeners also fell silent and waited with great suspense for the outcome of Michel's inspiration. Elemental cries then gushed forth from his tightly pressed lips, eventually venting themselves in a siren-like wailing. Many people regarded him as a charismatic. Others, who found his manner rather outlandish, preferred to explain his ecstasies as due to the restlessness of his soul. Imagine that happening in a German university in the middle of the 20th century. My experience, though, is that eccentric leaders are tolerated and largely ignored, and a culture is created around them that is independent of those kinds of eccentricities. So we want to look at the sort of people that Jesus is talking about, and we don't get to label them as eccentrics. These are really serious leaders who are marked by what Jesus calls hypocrisy. Hypocrisy. Over and over, we see this term in Matthew chapter 23. We want to define hypocrisy today. I'm the sort of person who likes to define the words that we're using, and I will contend with you today, and you will agree with me, whether you like it or not, that there are two kinds of hypocrisy in the pages of the Gospels. Maria Edgeworth once said, "Above all things, shun definitions. They will prove fatal to you." Well, I prefer Marilyn Chandler McIntyre, a professor at Westmont who gave some splendid lectures at Princeton, who said, "Precision begins with defining your terms." She said, "If your verbs are precise, I tell students, if they aim at who did what to whom in what way as specifically as possible, your writing will improve by 50%. She says, in a side note, "I made up that statistic." I'm precise with words, she said. Numbers are another matter. I want to be precise with numbers here. There's a lot of uses of this word hypocrisy. And we need to realize that leaders can create a toxic culture by hypocrisy, and that leaders can create a gospel culture by avoiding such hypocrisy. There's a little oddity here that I'm asked to talk about leaders when our leaders are in Africa. It has nothing to do with their absence. It has everything to do with the fact that this is the text assigned for me today. So I want to talk about hypocrisy, and I'm going to call it thin and thick. I was thinking of calling it light and dark, but there are people who would interpret that in entirely positive ways, if you know what I mean. Hypocrisy thin is the first point I'd like to make. Hypocrisy thin diminishes the individual leader of a church culture. Hypocrisy thin will diminish the leader. The Germans have a wonderful expression for this. It's called sein und schein, and that is who they are and how they appear. And hypocrisy thin examines who we really are and the appearance that other people see in us. In fact, the image that we create or the persona that we create in a public spectrum. To the text from Matthew chapter 23, verse 3 says this about the Pharisees. Oh, it's interesting that we skip verse 2, but I'll read it anyway. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat, which means they interpret the law in local synagogues. So you must be careful to do everything they tell you. They're pretty good interpreters of the Torah. But do not do what they do, for they do not practice what they preach. Now there is exactly what hypocrisy thin means. It's a contradiction from what we know to be true and what we want to be seen about us and what is actually going on inside us. Jesus thought the Pharisees' theology was good, often good. Their practices, however, did not match their theology. But Jesus digs deeper on hypocrisy thin. In verses 25 to 26, listen to these strong language words from Jesus. Woe to you, this is a strong term, woe, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. Now, they're not listening now because he's just pounded them on the head, but this is, he's not writing it just for them, or saying it. You clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they are full of greed and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and dish, and then the outside will also be clean. Look, he goes on. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You are like whitewashed tombs, which we know from customs, because if you touched a tombstone, you became unclean. And this became a particularly vexing problem in Jerusalem because people wanted to be buried in Jerusalem. But if you touched a tomb, you became unclean and you couldn't enter the temple, which is why they came to Jerusalem. So they cleaned the outside of tombs on the top so that you could see where they were and wouldn't step on them. You are like whitewashed tombs, which look beautiful on the outside, but on the inside are full of the bones of the dead and everything unclean. In the same way, on the outside, you Pharisees appear to people as righteous, but on the inside, you are full of hypocrisy and wickedness. Pretty strong language. Not the way to make friends. It's the way to make a point. And he's made his point that hypocrisy is the contradiction of who you are on the inside and the way you appear to people in the public. It is not a little clever that Jesus calls the people most concerned with purity in the Jewish world, the Pharisees, unclean on the inside, though you are clean on the outside. These are the people who wanted everybody to be clean, but who were on the inside themselves unclean. This is what I would call thin hypocrisy. Thin in the sense that it's the easiest way to perceive hypocrisy, but Jesus is going to dig deeper. The solution to thin hypocrisy is honesty, authenticity, genuineness, and that is that people know who you really are and that you don't put on a front. And Jesus wants leaders to be on the outside what they are on the inside, unless the inside's really messy, and then they shouldn't be leaders. So Jesus wants the inside and the outside to be in concert with one another. Thin hypocrisy, however, is a special kind of temptation for pastors and preachers and leaders. Helmut Thielicke, a powerful German theologian in the World War II era, talked about this temptation of preaching as a hypocrite and what it was like. In his autobiography, he said this, "The thing I found most difficult was having to preach when I was going through a profound spiritual crisis. If on the previous day I had been walking along C Street and had again bumped into the Nazi school teacher, I had difficulty in coping with my anger at the contemptuous way he had treated me. How could I then preach a sermon the next day on the text, Love Your Enemies? On Saturday, I received news that four of my former students," he said, "to whom I was particularly close, had been killed in World War II. And on the next day, I had to preach a sermon on joy in the Lord. How could I do that without hypocrisy? I was afraid I would lose any credibility. Simply to call the whole thing off, sermon canceled due to spiritual crisis, was not a viable option. I would cope with the distressing situation," Thielicke tells us, "by openly confessing my spiritual crisis from the pulpit." He said, "If I have to preach on joy today, then you should not think that my heart is overflowing with joy, that it is merely a case of opening my mouth and letting it flow out. I cannot speak lyrically of joy because I'm dejected and depressed. The text on joy stands like an alpine peak high above me while I flounder in the depths below. So I will try to make clear what message is being sent down from this peak to us in our grief. I thus always," he said, "attempted to be completely honest and not to say anything to the congregation that I was not at the same time prepared to say to myself. I was consequently also prepared to admit to them that I did not feel equal to a certain biblical passage. I was always strangely moved by the fact that it was precisely this honesty that made the congregation listen attentively to the sermon." The solution to thin hypocrisy is what Helmut Thielicke would call truth and truthfulness. I'm going to move to a second sense of hypocrisy, but before I do that, I have to tell you that I can look pretty smart talking about hypocrisy in this next text, but I learned everything about this from a friend of mine named David Garland, who wrote a book called The Intention of Matthew 23. I've been teaching his theory of hypocrisy for 30 years. I no longer know what he wrote and what I think. I would be a hypocrite. Thin. I'm not a thick hypocrite yet. A thin hypocrite, if I didn't tell you that I learned it from him, but there's no footnotes in sermons. So I told you this because I think this is important to see of what I'm doing. So I'd like to move now from thin hypocrisy, which is, I think, how we like to use the word, to a far more central idea that Jesus has in mind when he talks about hypocrisy. I think the contradiction between the inner and the outer is just the beginning of what Jesus is talking about. And the text that we read from Micah, from Psalms, and then gloriously the opposite from the Apostle Paul in 1 Thessalonians illustrate precisely what hypocrisy is all about. It's about leaders who create a church culture that is toxic. Hypocrisy thick, then, creates a toxic church culture. What is the difference between thin and thick? I have a friend who's a professional golfer. He was. His name is Kermit. You can imagine what he's asked about. One time we were in a hotel together, and I said, Kermit, what goes through your head when you putt? Say, a 10-foot putt. And he started talking. 15 minutes later, I said, will you answer my question? And he said, I'm just about at the point where I can answer it. When he was done, I thought, I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm trying to knock a ball in a hole, and he's the only one who understands putting. And that's sort of what I want to talk about, is the distinction between a sort of a superficial hypocrisy, which isn't good, and a thick hypocrisy. Thick hypocrisy is explored in this text. In Matthew chapter 23, verses 5 through 7, we learn that a hypocrite is someone who is motivated by observation and congratulation. Listen to this. Everything they do is done for people to see. They make their phylacteries wide. Now, these are leather pouches with leather straps, and they wrap them around an arm, and they wrap them around their head. And if you make a thicker one, everyone knows you've got yours on. And they make their tzitzit, the hems of their garment. The text here says the tassels, long, so they flow on the ground. And they look like someone right out of Hollywood with their celebrity gowns on. So they make these things long so they can be seen. They love the place of honor at banquets, which means sitting closer to the people that matter rather than way off at the end. And you may know the parable that Jesus told, which was humorous, that when you get invited to a banquet, move to the worst seat imaginable, and then they'll bump you up because you're more important than someone, and you can feel good about yourself. Because there's worse sitting next to the celebrity and then getting bumped down. Jesus is against this sort of mentality of desiring the place of honor at banquets and the most important seats in the synagogues. They love to be greeted with respect in the marketplace and to be called rabbi by others. This is hypocrisy for Matthew. To desire as a leader to be noticed, to be the desire to be seen as someone important. Verses 8 to 12, Jesus will call someone a hypocrite because they love titles. They love titles. But you are not to be called rabbi. For you have one teacher, and you are all brothers and sisters. And do not call anyone on earth father, for you have one father, and he is in heaven. Nor are you to be called instructors, teachers, for you have one instructor, the Messiah. So, what do you call me as a professor? You know, I've always asked my students to call me Scott, because that's what my parents call me, all right? And usually what Chris calls me. All right. So, we are brothers. And there are some people who cannot wait to be given a name. Pastor, priest, father, professor, doctor. And Jesus says, no, you've got one teacher. And it's me. And you can call me Lord. And you can call me Messiah and Son of God and Son of Man and teacher and instructor, but you are not to have titles. This is a very radical position. But it is the love for titles that is hypocritical. And then he says in verse 13, it's the abuse of a teaching platform. Verse 13 says, woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You shut the door of the kingdom of heaven in people's faces. You yourselves do not enter, nor will you allow those enter who are trying to. Here it is their teaching position that is abusive that he criticizes. In verse 15, Woe to you, teachers of the law, you hypocrites. You travel over land and sea to win a single convert. Now listen to this, these words. And when you have succeeded, you make them twice as much a son of hell as you are yourselves. Strong language. Verses 16 through 22 continues it. Blind guides, if anyone swears by the temple, it means nothing. Anyone who swears by the gold of the temple is bound by that oath. You blind fools, which is greater, the gold or the temple? So they have all these interpretive skills that have broken everything down, and they're leading people away from God, leading people away from the truth of God instead of leading them to God. A hypocrite, then, is someone who has a position of leadership and abuses it and uses it in a way that destroys the culture they're supposed to create. That's a hypocrite for Jesus. That's hypocrisy thick. Hypocrisy thick is to be leaders and to destroy the culture that we are designed to create. Thick hypocrisy is when leaders abuse power and create a culture contrary to Christ. Thick hypocrisy is a toxic culture. It is a culture centered on the leader and not on Jesus. It is, however, far more subtle than even thin hypocrisy, frequently indetectable to the outsiders. No one knew what was really going on when we discover about some pastor or priest or leader. It was invisible what they were doing. Structures were created that protected this power that they had. It was intentional. These people didn't accidentally discover power and that they could use it. They manipulated it to their own advantage. It's insufferable. Once we discover it, we cannot stand what we hear. It is therefore inexcusable. Worst of all, it creates a culture that blocks the gospel and prevents people from hearing who Jesus is. What is the solution to thick hypocrisy? Thin hypocrisy, the solution is honesty. Thick hypocrisy is transformation. It's transformation to be like the Apostle Paul in 1 Thessalonians that we read today. It is transformation that when the leader says, I'm not in charge here, Jesus is. Don't call me pastor. Don't call me doctor. Don't call me professor. Don't look at me as a celebrity. We are all underneath King Jesus, and he's the one who's in charge here. It is to create a culture where people come to see Jesus, not to come see us, where we're not a celebrity as leaders, but instead we are witnesses to Jesus and windows through which we give people an opportunity to see who Jesus is. This is found in Matthew 23, but it is taught by Jesus back a few chapters in Matthew 20 when his disciples were debating about who was the MVP of the apostolic band. Can we sit on the one on the left and one on the right? This is what James and John say. But they're put up to it by their mother, who's a sister of Mary. So this family problem is dysfunctional at the leadership level. Right? And Jesus says, this is the way the Gentiles act. They love to lord it over all. He says, look at me. I'm the Messiah. And I did not come to be served, but to serve and to give my life a ransom for many. This becomes a paradigm in Paul's writings. In Philippians 2, he tells the story of Jesus, though equal with God, empties himself to the point of the cross, which is horrible for a Jew, all the way to death, and then he was exalted. So the way to be a leader is to serve. And when we serve Christ, we create a gospel culture rather than a leadership culture, rather than a toxic culture. Genuine Christian leadership then leads people to see Jesus. Genuine Christian culture is when a leader declares and demonstrates and enculturates that Christ is king in this community, where Christ is the center, where everyone realizes that we're not leaders, we're followers. Now, I'd like to illustrate what I think this kind of culture can actually create for leaders. When thin hypocrisy diminishes a leader's personal influence, thick hypocrisy destroys a Christian and a gospel culture. When the culture, however, becomes focused on Jesus, and thick hypocrisy is not to be seen, and thin hypocrisy is rarely seen, we find that the institutions, the people, the church, the priests, the pastors begin to witness to who Jesus is. While acting in the role of a priest in Father Brown in Burgundy, France, Alec Guinness, known to many of us as Obi-Wan Kenobi, and when I read this, I had to ask my son, Lucas, which one of them is Obi-Wan Kenobi? I don't know this stuff. He was in this mega hit movie called Star Wars. Okay, I read books on hypocrisy. Alec Guinness, anyway, but he has a story called Blessings in Disguise. It's a very good book. In a late evening shoot that attracted a fairly good number of local folk, including children, in his autobiography, he talks about an amazingly wonderful experience of being mistaken for a priest. France, Catholics, all right? A room, he says, had been put at my disposal in the little station hotel 3 kilometers away. By the time dusk fell, I was bored, and dressed in my priestly black, I climbed the gritty, winding road to the village. All right. In the square, children were squealing, having mock battles with sticks for swords and dustbin lids for shields. And in a cafe, Peter Finch, Bernard Lee, and Robert Hammer, you may know who they are, they're probably movie stars, were sampling their first Pernod, if you know what that is, and for the evening, I joined them for a modest cur, whatever that is, then discovering I wouldn't be needed for at least 4 hours, turned back towards the station. By now, he said, it was dark. I hadn't gone far when I heard scampering footsteps and a piping voice calling out, Mon Père, my father, a priestly word. My hand was seized by a boy of 7 or 8 who clutched it tightly, swung it, and kept up a nonstop prattle. He was full of excitement, hops, skips, and jumps, but never let go of me. I didn't dare speak in case my excruciating French would scare him off. Now, here's what happens when a church culture embodies itself in institutions like the priestly garb and the collars that we wear. For people, because Jesus is being seen through them. Although, he said, I was a total stranger, he obviously took me for a priest and so to be trusted. Suddenly, with a bonsoir, mon père, good night, my father, and a hurried sideways sort of bow, he disappeared through a hole in the hedge. Now, listen to what happens to Alec Guinness, Obi-Wan Kenobi, if you'd prefer. That little boy had a happy, reassuring walk home, and I was left with an odd sense of elation. Continuing my walk, I reflected that a church that could inspire such confidence in a child, think about that, making its priests even when unknown, so easily approachable, could not be as scheming and creepy as the media makes it out to be. Alec Guinness became a Christian that night. That is leadership in the church. When the institutions embody the message, we're good leaders. Until then, we have to shed thin and thick hypocrisies. You can read about Alec Guinness in his book, Blessings in Disguise. What was here, nothing but clothing, the garb of a priest, told the story of God's grace and witness to a little child. May each of us, in whatever forms of leadership we find ourselves, parents, work, ministers, whatever we do, may we embody this message, and may we show this to people through who we are. Thank you.